Thank you. Thank you so much for coming this morning. Does everybody have the handout? This is the teacher in me asking. I want to talk a little bit about the handout before I move into my talk itself. And is that too loud? Is it good? Can we all hear? All right. Because I'm a teacher, I'm used to just talking and getting people to hear me. So the sort of larger sense of what I want to do today is wrestle with the narrative that is out in the culture about the decline of every single church denomination, including our friends in the Southern Baptist Church, including the Catholic Church. Without immigration, we're told that the Catholic Church would also be on a sort of downslide. And so what you'll notice here is that under the cultural story, there is this larger story of Christian decline across all denominations and the rise of what we call the nuns, not the N-U-N-S, but the N-O-N-E-S. That would be awesome, though, wouldn't it? I would love to live in a culture in which nuns were on the upswing. But what we're discovering is that there is this sort of generational change in which people are moving away from organized religion, and most of them are not coming back. And so this sense that we had 50 years ago in which it was a normative sort of thing to be a person in organized religion is disappearing. And in relation to that, the Barna Group, which is an evangelical Christian focus group, did a study in 2015 where they tried to figure out why it is that people are moving away from organized religion. What is it that helps us to account for this story? And what they discovered is that for many people, they did not believe that religion would fill a particular role in their lives that they think that they need. And so if we could look at that very quickly, this thing under Barna Group. They felt, first, that when they thought about religion, it was people meeting together on a regular basis who were not a part of each other's lives. So there was not this sense of community, which we associate with real religion. Secondly, they felt that it didn't serve a necessary societal need. Third, and this is a really painful thing to wrestle with, and often as Christians in the Episcopal story, we get lumped in with every other Christian in America. Because, of course, the normative way of doing the way of Jesus in America is not necessarily the Episcopal way. We are a tiny group in comparison with some other denominations. But there is this sense in the culture that Christians stand for the wrong things. An evangelical leader the other day was saying, well, you know, it's probably okay if a Saudi journalist got murdered in Turkey as long as we don't jeopardize our arms deals. And wherever you may stand politically, that's a human rights sort of problem. That as we think about where Jesus would be on this, Jesus probably is not on the side of the arms deals. And so for this idea that Christianity stands for the wrong things, war, moralism, judgment, and political action. And then finally, the last thing that the Barna Group study discovered is that oftentimes Christian leaders, they said, were led by those who have not earned their positions by loving others. And so there is this narrative out in the culture that to be Christian is to be a certain thing. And I don't recognize that story because of the tradition that I have entered into and come to love. But one of the things that I think is most important for us as we gather together and think about who we are this morning is that it is essential for us to tell our story about what it means to follow Jesus. And so when we think about Bishop Curry, our presiding bishop, saying, you know, it is really important for us to tell the story of what it means to be a part of the Episcopal branch of the Jesus movement. Because there is this misconception, this badly told story about who we are, what we stand for, what it is that we're supposed to be doing. And so I hope that as we think about this sort of cultural narrative, we can talk about how we might push back against that. So that's the first thing that I want to say. The second thing is I want to also acknowledge I come from an evangelical tradition. And as I was telling some folks this morning, I was raised Southern Baptist. And we were taught that we were supposed to express our faith out into the world, which is not an Episcopal story. And so I want to talk a little bit about that, and that is an ongoing problem and opportunity for everyone who is in the Episcopal Church to think about how do we let people know about our story, and how can we do it in a way that feels culturally appropriate for us. When I was growing up in the Southern Baptist Church, we were taught that it was okay to walk up to people in the streets and talk to them about Jesus, and I don't really feel comfortable about that. I didn't feel comfortable then. But I do feel more comfortable telling my story, which is that, as I was saying earlier, the Episcopal Church saved my life. It rescued me. It turned my life around. And I think that that is a story that has power and utility in a lot of ways. And so as we think about the different ways that we might tell our stories, the second thing on the handout is that I'm not going to talk about every single one of these things, but these are what we might think of as talking points for the Episcopal Church. What are the things that we do maybe better than anybody else that would be worth working into the stories we tell to people? So as we talk together this morning, perhaps this will be of use to you as we move forward to think about the different things that we offer that not everybody else has in their particular story. So, the second thing that I want to do besides introduce you to the handout, which I did spend, you know, maybe not hours, but certainly minutes putting together for you, is I want to offer greetings from your brothers and sisters at St. David's Church in Austin, where I'm privileged to serve, and the American Cathedral in Paris, where I am writer in residence. Right now, I am in residence in Paris, mostly in my head. But I have the great privilege of serving there every summer, and I'm going also back in a couple of weeks to finish the book on race and film that Chad was talking about. And if you are not aware that the Episcopal Church has a presence in Europe, it does, in a number of different cities, and our cathedral church is in Paris, and it is a lovely, lovely place. And should you ever come, you would find an amazing welcome. So I offer you those greetings this morning. Oh, and the last thing is I want to thank Chad for this is the not only caffeinated version of Dr. Pepper, but whole sugar version. In Baylor, where I teach, Waco, Texas is the home of Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper was created in Waco, Texas by a druggist. And there really is not much better in the world than an original kind of Dr. Pepper. So any good thing that comes out of my talk with you this morning is probably coming out of this bottle. So a couple of years ago at St. David's Austin, we had to flee the buildings when the fire alarms went off. It was the Sunday closest to the Feast of Epiphany. And it will not perhaps surprise you that a children's Sunday school teacher set off the fire alarms by burning frankincense as an Epiphany lesson. When I was the convention speaker for the General Convention of the Diocese of Delaware a couple of years ago, an incense-loving rector told me that this was his greatest fear. And yes, Chad, this is a thing. You can actually set off the fire alarms by burning incense. Now, any fears that we had that our buildings would be engulfed in flames were quickly extinguished. But all the same, the law is the law. And so the church filed out onto the city streets, into the parking garage, down onto the labyrinth. Rabbi Neil Blumhoff, an old friend of our congregation, relocated the class that he was teaching on Sarah and Abraham to the deck outside our coffee shop. The choir stood out on the corner of 7th and San Jacinto and regaled passersby with song as they practiced the anthem for the Holy Eucharist. Now, it was in some ways a very atypical Sunday morning. But in one way, it was typical. We reminded people that St. David's is not a building, but the people who exit the building and interact with the world outside, the people released by our benediction to love and serve the Lord. Now, as a writer, teacher, and theologian, I am a sucker for stories, especially stories that look like they can tell us something about ourselves, our institutions, or about God. And this particular story seems to illustrate some things that I've been thinking about for a long time, at least since I started seminary. A few years ago, Church Publishing invited me to write a book about the Episcopal Church. It's a book that they called My Church Is Not Dying, Episcopalians in the 21st Century. And as Chad mentioned to you, it's a collection of stories and conclusions about the life-giving elements of our tradition, an attempt to remind ourselves and to tell others why we have chosen to follow Jesus in this particular way, and to assert that what we are finding life-giving in our tradition might also be life-giving to those who have not found us yet. My Church Is Not Dying is, of course, a catchy but ridiculous title. I was writing this book, as some of you may have guessed, in response to all of those gleeful reports of our demise, the declines in membership, the internecine struggles. But the tradition of which we are a part has been literally life-saving for me, and has, I know, been integral in the lives and formations of those of you who are here this morning. You don't come out on a rainy morning to talk about the Episcopal Church unless you care about the Episcopal Church. And that's what I wanted to communicate in writing, the idea that it continues to be a vital and powerful tradition for us, and could be for people that God hasn't introduced us to yet. So, it may seem to passers-by that the church is on fire, but I think that grants us even more license to carry our music out into the streets, our teaching out into the courtyard, and to tell some great stories about who we are and how we find ourselves here. In writing the book, I asked people to tell me stories. I asked Rowan Williams to tell me about his first memories of Anglican worship. I asked the past presiding bishop to tell me what it felt like to preside over a particularly fractious period in our history. I asked priests and bishops about their favorite vocational moments. In his foreword to the book, for example, Greg Rickle, the Bishop of Olympia, writes that for him there is nothing more powerful than the moment when he lays hands on a confirmand and something holy and mysterious happens. We all know what he's talking about. Like the great guitarist of U2, The Edge, I like to say at such times, God walks in the room. Jules, my favorite character from Pulp Fiction, would say, God got involved. But I gathered a bunch of other stories besides that. Another of our seminary classmates, Stacy Walker, a priest in Illinois, talked about the Facebook invitation that she posted, inviting everyone to get married in her church. On the first day, all couples can attain a wedding license in Illinois. I'm sharing this link to my church's website about weddings. For her, the chance to declare God's love for everybody and to celebrate it with a sacrament was a game changer. I asked lay people when they realized the Episcopal or Anglican tradition was going to be their home and why they stayed. I asked people who have never even been a formal part of our tradition, but who have resonated with our stands on justice and equality, what they thought about us. In the process, I heard stories that inspired me, stories that assured me that this tradition we love has plenty to offer to a broken world that is filled with conflict, despair, and hopelessness. Like me, the people who told me their stories were meeting God in our liturgy and beautiful worship experiences, in day-to-day connections with God and with other people, and in the thoughtful and communal experience of discerning how God is still moving in the world. They offered me wonderful stories about paying attention, about reminding ourselves that being Episcopalian means that we're formed by the formal sacraments, but also alert to a world in which God is incarnate, and where informal sacraments can and do shape who we are. In the Celtic tradition, from which St. Bede's comes, We find the idea of thin places, the saying that heaven is only 6 feet above a person's head, the belief that Christ accompanies us as our brother and companion on the way, as my favorite Welsh Eucharist would have it. The Celtic tradition, as John Philip Newell has taught, is closely aligned to the Johannine tradition. And the title of Philip's seminal introduction to Celtic Christianity, and if you're not familiar with it, I would encourage you to take a look at it, is Listening to the Heartbeat of God. It's a reference to how the Celts understood Revelation to be something akin to what the beloved disciple discerned when he reclined on Jesus' chest at the Last Supper. You cannot follow God without knowing where and how God is moving. That's why attention to what is saving lives in our parishes, in our communities, in our own lives, seems like an important starting point. That's why stories about how God is moving and where people are finding meaning, those archetypal spiritual stories told and retold in our faith, in our culture, in our individual stories, are so vital. Attention. I know from sad experience that it is easier to talk about paying attention than it is to actually do it. Even though that's my job, as writer, teacher, preacher, I find it hard sometimes to be aware. My spiritual director tells me, often, I'm afraid, how hard it is to live in the present. And I need reminders over and over again about the lessons that God is trying to teach me. I need them from the scriptures. I need them from the pulpit. I need them from my library. I need them from the movie screen. And I need them in the words of those that I encounter. And I need to be listening to how the stories move, how the settings change, how the characters shift and flow if I'm going to discern where exactly God is at this moment, so that I can follow. A couple of years ago, Bono, the lead singer and primary lyricist of U2, was asked to preach at the National Prayer Breakfast. After an opening prayer, "Mr. President, First Lady, King Abdullah, other heads of state, members of Congress, distinguished guests, please join me in praying that I don't say something we'll all regret." He arrived at what was the most profound spiritual lesson in his homily. His message that God was on the move, and we might have to pay attention to keep up. "A number of years ago," Bono said, "I met a wise man who changed my life. In countless ways, large and small, I was always seeking the Lord's blessing. I was saying, you know, I have a new song, look after it. I have a family, please look after them. I have this crazy idea." And this wise man said, "Stop." He said, "Stop asking God to bless what you're doing. Get involved in what God is doing, because it is already blessed." For those of us in the church, for those of us who read about how to save the church, for the creators or administrators of marvelous programs, for those of us who are shaping the future of our institutions, in other words, for pretty much all of us who are sitting here this morning, this story offers a jarring but absolutely necessary insight. Sadly, we don't get to tell God stories about how God should be moving, or how we would like God to be moving, or why this particular phenomenal idea is one God should really get behind. What we are called to do is listen and to discern where God is moving at this moment. And that may require us to reassess some things. I have a dear friend, Phyllis Tickle, of blessed memory. She wrote a wonderful book called The Great Emergence. And in that book, she opined that every 500 years, the church cleans house and holds a rummage sale. It gets rid of things that no longer work or just taking up space to make room for new furniture, new fixtures, a new way of life. It has been, as some of you are aware, 500 years since Martin Luther launched the Protestant Reformation by nailing his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Church. And according to Phyllis's theory, and the very clear changes that are taking place around us, we are in the midst of another of those garage sales. Now, I don't know about you, but I have held more than one garage sale, and I do not like them. Will anybody show up? Will they value my collector's item antler chair the same way that I do? Maybe it would be better just to hold on to my stuff, to buy a storage unit, to keep this the way it's always been, instead of having to interact with all these people I may not even know. The prospect of wholesale change is daunting, even frightening. We have our ways of doing, our ways of being, and it can be hard to live with the mystery and the uncertainty that comes when you don't see the next thing yet. That is just human nature. But as I told you earlier, I believe that I am here today at St. Bede's and on the planet generally to proclaim the good news that our communities of faith are here not just to save souls, but to save lives. And because I can testify to that movement in my own life, even in the midst of the rummage sale, I am here to bear witness that these challenging times are not some kind of end, but a new beginning. At my office at Baylor, I have a coffee cup given to me by an ex-wife in a loving moment. It bears the Chinese ideogram or Hanza for crisis. And there's a short inspirational note on the back of the coffee cup. John Kennedy, Condoleezza Rice, Al Gore are just a few of the many people over the year who have told the same story that my coffee cup tells, that in Mandarin Chinese, the word for crisis is made up of the individual characters meaning danger and opportunity. Now, it turns out that this is not actually true. Sadly, it is, as we say sometimes of the historic creeds, if it's not true, it ought to be. But here's what it might mean to say that crisis is a marriage of danger and opportunity. When we face danger, it is only human for our fight or flight mechanisms to go to work. We might circle the wagons to fight off the opposing threat, or maybe we run for our lives hoping to outdistance it. Or if you're anything like me, maybe we pull the covers up over our heads and try and pretend we don't know about the threat. If we don't see it, it won't see us. But these moments in our lives of danger and potential destruction also offer clear opportunities for change, growth, and renewal. You know from your own life how difficult it is to make important, even necessary, changes in the middle of the day-to-day. Often it is not until things fall apart, in times when we must change or die, that we are able to do what we ought to have started doing a long time ago. That was the case in my own life, and that could be the situation for us in the Episcopal Church as well. We can see the crisis of the last five decades as an opportunity to change and to grow, as well as to go on offering the world some things that it desperately needs. So, what does it mean to follow Jesus in a time of danger and opportunity? What do we as Episcopalians have to offer this rapidly changing world? A lot of the people that I talked to for my book talked about what might it mean to be doing this kingdom work if it is less about just opening the doors on Sunday morning and more about inviting people into our story. My bishop, Andy Doyle, in the Diocese of Texas, says, and this is actually what he says, so please forgive me if this is crude, it is less about butts in the pews and more about touching people 24/7. It's about inviting people into relationship and reaching out to them in new ways. It's about stepping out of our churches and into our communities. So I firmly believe my church is not dying. But it is changing. And perhaps we have to change in order to follow how God is moving in the world. A couple of years ago, my friend Rachel Held Evans, a millennial religious writer, published a book called Searching for Sunday: Loving, Leaving, and Finding the Church. It was a best-selling book about her journey from evangelical Christianity to the Episcopal Church. And when I interviewed her about her journey, which I had been watching over the years, it was partly about no longer being able to believe that God didn't love every single one of God's children. But it was also about confession, about the historic creeds, about the Eucharistic prayer. Episcopal liturgy helped to draw one of America's most famous evangelical Christians into our tradition. And she is, every day, in speaking, in social media, in the books she's writing, telling the world about it, proclaiming it around the clock. And what I hope and see is that her story is freeing other people to tell their stories and to set out on their own journeys of discovery. I have to say, though, it strikes me as a little sad that Rachel is telling our story so widely and so well. She's doing it because she was evangelical before she became one of us. It would seem odd to her not to tell her story. After I became one, I discovered that Episcopalians pride ourselves in not forcing our beliefs on others. We often wait for people to ask before we tell our stories. And we sometimes tell people what we believe largely by the bumper stickers on our cars. Now, I am certain that sometimes the Spirit moves and our cars are in the right place at the right time. But I want to suggest that our bumper stickers do not say enough about who we are and what we believe. I am proud to be an Episcopalian, more than proud. My identity as an Episcopal follower of Christ is one of the central defining elements of who I am. I first found joy and life and community in the Episcopal Church. I discovered my vocation in the Episcopal Church. I encountered most of the friends who have shaped and continue to shape my life in the Episcopal Church. I met my wife in the Episcopal Church. I owe so much to the church that there are times I am baffled why everybody else in America does not see what I see. And then I am forced to admit, how can they see all these wonders when we are not bringing them to their attention? All right, many of us do have a sticker on our cars. But I want to suggest that we need to find some additional and maybe some better ways to tell others about the church, about our particular congregations, about our faith, about how God might be moving in our lives. And, of course, because we are Episcopalians, we need to find a way to do it in such a way that we don't remind people of those pushy Christians, since that reinforces all of the negative impressions that the culture has about Christianity. So, since we have been talking this morning about telling our stories, I want to encourage you to tell stories, not just stories that you have overheard or observed, but to tell your own story when it's appropriate. That is, when it's not about directing attention to yourself, but about directing attention to God at work. This is not vanity to tell your own story. It is a gift to tell someone how you have seen God moving in your life. My bishop, Andy Doyle, suggests pick three of your favorite things about your church. Write them down if it helps. He talks about it in the context of elevator conversation. You know, if you've got 30 seconds to talk to somebody, what would you say about why you love your church? Because he says, we are so often not ready to respond if somebody is open to hearing anything about our faith. Now, I know that this is all alien to Episcopalians. I came from this tradition where we were supposed to walk up to strangers on the street and talk about Jesus. I came into this tradition where we're not supposed to talk to anybody about Jesus. But there is this lovely old 19th century hymn sung often by Quakers and offered up most memorably in the last 100 years, perhaps, by Pete Seeger and Enya. It's called, How Can I Keep from Singing? You probably know it. My favorite verse goes like this. No storm can shake my inmost calm, while to that refuge clinging, since Christ is Lord of heaven and earth, how can I keep from singing? That question is not rhetorical. If Christ is Lord of heaven and earth, if God is moving in the world and in my life, how can I be silent about it? And yet, too often, I fear we are silent about it, hoping that our priests or our bishop or our church staff or the sign outside or, please God, somebody besides me will do that hard and beautiful work for us. So let me say, we do not have to walk up to strangers on the street, ask if they have discovered Jesus, invite them to church. Although, honestly, inviting someone to church would be a huge step forward for most of us. Telling people that they are welcome somewhere, anywhere, is one of the best pieces of good news that I know, especially when most people don't feel welcome in their homes, in their own bodies. Our friend, the Reverend David Boyd, the retired rector of St. David's, Austin, returned from a sabbatical spent traveling in the UK to remark on his favorite British phrase, "You are very welcome." How lovely he preached for anyone to say to us, you are welcome here. So in the last part of my talk, I'd like to tell you a couple of the stories that I told in the book about other ways that Episcopalians are reaching out to the world outside the walls. So we've told some stories about how liturgy and our tradition, our theology have attracted people, and these are powerful and vital stories for us. But I think it's also important for us to think about some of the stories that we could tell about how we are moving in the larger world and to offer some possibilities for you and your own communities, whether here in St. Bede's or elsewhere. I'd like to start with something called Laundry Love, which began at an Episcopal parish in California and now is being done by churches, mosques, and synagogues across the United States. It is a program that we do at St. David's in Austin. Typically, we do it on one of the last nights in the month when working people are looking at their bank accounts and discovering that there is no money left in them for things like laundry. on these publicized nights, volunteers take over a laundromat, and they offer the homeless and the working poor laundry detergent, quarters, and often a hot meal or food from a food bank. Shannon Kassoff, a lay leader from Huntington Beach, California, where Laundry Love started, says that Laundry Love is our church. It is probably the best way to be involved in other people's lives, not just handing out food in a soup kitchen. We get to know them, and that's probably the best part of this whole deal. This is probably the most meaningful thing that we do because we are taking our love outside of the walls of the church, bringing it to the people and sharing what we think is an amazing experience, and that's just love. What happens when Laundry Love is in the house? Communities happen. Social capital gets formed, miracles nobody imagined. Here's how the Huntington Beach Laundry Love website describes what happened one night recently. One of our regular volunteers said of our most recent Laundry Love, this one just blew my mind. We had volunteers from Mariners Church, from St. John's and Laverne, who are wanting to start their own Laundry Love, some folks from other Episcopal churches, and a regular group of men from the Islamic Center of Orange County. The Islamic Center provided the Middle Eastern meal and led our prayer. We didn't start out to be interfaith. We didn't start out to be any faith. But that's what's happened. The structure just started forming. The web that holds us grows stronger. And when we're there, we don't talk about religion. It's more of an experience, an opportunity to enjoy one another, to get to know the locals, and to allow ourselves to be of service. When we began Laundry Love, what we did was provide money and laundry supplies so that people who needed a hand could get their laundry done free. Soon our services expanded to include a meal, and then groceries became part of the project. We have made friends, watched fortunes change, have seen people who had been living on the streets for years come in not to do their laundry, but to offer donations and lend a hand. Sometimes people stumble on us accidentally and fortuitously when a bit of hard work has come their way, and then they experience a bit of grace. Grace doesn't just happen in church. We know that. If we take incarnation seriously, we've agreed that what happens at the altar on Sunday morning is far from the only way that God is being made manifest in the world. Take what happens when Episcopalians carry our liturgy out into communities on Ash Wednesday. Ashes to Go was started by the Reverend Teresa Danieli in St. Louis in 2007. When she took to a busy street corner in her city to offer the imposition of ashes to passersby. It's now an international phenomenon, and while not everyone I know likes it, it is fast food liturgy, as its detractors suggest, which is kind of the whole point in a culture where many people can eat fast food but don't have time to sit down for a long, leisurely meal. I've eschewed the formal Ash Wednesday liturgy myself for a number of years to receive my ashes on a street corner. I have this tradition of loving the long and beautiful liturgy of the Ash Wednesday service, but imposing or receiving ashes on a street as curious people walk by, walk back, finally ask somebody, what the hell is going on here? That is another way for us to tell our stories. My wife, Jeannie, used to be the communications director at St. David's. She would come down from the church to take pictures, and as we stood on the busy corner of 6th Street and Congress in downtown Austin, we would watch our priests and lay people alike climb into buses and lean into taxicabs to draw the black cross upon a driver's forehead. We saw lapsed Catholics break into tears at the remembered ritual. The familiar words of imposition, remember that you are dust, and to dust you will return. We heard children ask their mothers what was happening, and sometimes the mothers led them over for an explanation. We saw office workers in dresses and suits walk by, receive their ashes, walk on down the street to lunch or go back to work. Now, does Ashes to Go convey the impact of our Ash Wednesday service, the service that for us at St. David's was going on back in the historic sanctuary? Well, no, not in the same way. But here is the hard truth. None of the people who had ashes imposed on 6th and Congress on Ash Wednesday were ever going to enter the doors of our church. But nonetheless, something happens there that is very much like the Ash Wednesday miracle that Walker Percy describes at the climax of his great novel, The Moviegoer. Through some dim, dazzling trick of grace, as he put it, God is present on the corner of 6th and Congress. Jeannie and I have agreed that Ashes to Go makes us proud to be members of St. David's. It says something about who we are, about the story that we are living in, when we go out to engage the world with the most precious things that God has given us. Now, what does a new world look like where Episcopal people are worrying less about doing church than they are about being church? The last thing I'd like to submit to you is maybe it looks like the life and work of the Episcopal author and activist John Green, one of the most popular young adult novelists in America. You may know him for his best-known book, The Fault in Our Stars, which is about two teens who meet and fall in love at a cancer support group held in the basement of an Episcopal church. And Green has talked about how that book grew out of the 5 months he spent as a chaplain in a children's hospital. John Green, in fact, was doing his chaplaincy as part of his discernment for the Episcopal priesthood. His time doing clinical pastoral education convinced him he would not be a good pastor. CPE claimed another victim. And that perhaps his gifts were better used elsewhere. He still loves the church, though. And you can hear it when he explains to people outside our tradition that priests in the Episcopal Church can marry and stuff. They can be ladies. They can be gay. They can be all the things you know that humans are. So maybe it's true he decided not to go into ministry. But as Michelle Dean put it in a profile in The New Yorker, you could say that in his career as a young adult novelist, he's become another sort of evangelist. Or, as we might say, using language more appropriate to our tradition, another sort of priest. While John Green chose not to be a church leader standing in a pulpit or at an altar, in a very real sense, he serves as a priest for a huge community of readers, viewers, and activists who have gathered around his work and a thoughtful, engaged, communal desire to make the world a better place. The word that's translated as church in the New Testament, the Greek word, as some of you know, is ekklesia. It's a group of people who come together in order to do something important, to give themselves to something larger than themselves. And those who have gathered around John Green call themselves not a church, they call themselves nerd fighters. And they pledge to reduce world suck. Pungent, but poignant mission statement. And here's the thing. John Green touches more people as an author and as a YouTuber and as an activist than he ever could have as a priest. And his lessons are lessons that we as a church could absorb if we have not already. He's a compelling storyteller. He engages powerful issues of the day, as well as the personal issues, the human issues that we all face. He creates spaces for people to think and to feel and to talk to each other. And he uses social media with skill to reach out to people 24/7. The Fault in Our Stars has sold over 10 million copies. The videos he and his brother Hank have posted on various nerdfighter sites on YouTube have been viewed 1 billion times. He has 3 million followers on Twitter, 2 million on Facebook. So although the Nerdfighters community is linked largely through social media and shared stories, it does almost all the things that we say ekklesia is supposed to do. They support and love each other. They teach each other how to be better human beings. They join together to do good work. Nerdfighters raise money for corporate projects that will reduce suck. And they carry out projects on their own, inspired by that community. So on the one hand, you might have the larger community of nerd fighters raising money for Save the Children. And on the other hand, you might have individual members handing out kites on the street and encouraging people to have a great day. And all of this is familiar to us. We know this story. The connection, the call to live better and more authentic lives, the recognition that it's more important that we be working together and hoping together than anything else. Reflecting on his time as a chaplain and as an aspirant for holy orders in the Episcopal Church, John Green said in one of his YouTube videos, "All that stuff I did has been incredibly useful to me as a person in terms of thinking about how we care for other persons. What is really interesting to me is the opportunity to care for people and to think about how best to care for people, how most respectfully to care for people, what helps and what doesn't, what questions are the right questions, what questions are the wrong questions." There is something very Episcopalian about that response. And not only does John regularly and publicly claim his Episcopal faith, not only does he make beautiful art that wrestles with the big questions, not only is he helping to build these virtual and actual communities built around mutual support and care for each other and doing peace and justice, he's even launched a contemporary litany and set of manual actions, the catchphrases and gang signs that nerd fighters around the world know, use, and value. I am especially drawn to the nerd fighter catchphrase, "Don't forget to be awesome," which, coming as it usually does at the end of one of John's videos, focuses us back on our work in the world, just like the dismissal in our services. It feels like some hip and beautiful new Episcopal liturgy. So whatever it is that the church is going to look, sound, and act like in years to come, I am hoping that one of our models for it will be the work of John Green, who knows what it means to touch people all week long. So what Laundry Love and Ashes to Go and John Green have in common is considerable, and not just that they all offer us evidence that substantial and growing numbers of people want to feel that they are part of something bigger than themselves, even if they don't necessarily want to plop down in our pews. They show us that the model that has always been our guide, the story of God reaching out in love to a broken and hurting world through Christ Jesus, remains just as valid today as it did when the church began. They show us that with initiative and hard work, we can join with those who know deep in their hearts that we are the ones who are called to make the world better through acts of compassion and justice, through our attempts to create communities that love and support each other in this very hard work of being human. And so I believe firmly that my church is not dying. I don't care if it never again has as many Episcopalians on the rolls as it did in the 1950s. What matters is what Episcopalians are doing now, how we are reaching out into the world and proclaiming the kingdom of God. And even if someday all of us Episcopalians fit into a single laundromat, I would not despair. I would just invite others to the feast, hand out detergent and quarters, and praise God from whom all blessings flow. So, I want to thank you again for being here this morning. Thank you for the work that you are doing at St. Bede's or at your own communities on behalf of God's kingdom. It's a joy and an inspiration to be with you. And so I close with this, my coffee cup, crisis. That is what is awaiting us out there. Danger and opportunity walking hand in hand. A world full of people waiting to be invited into relationship with us and with the God who created and loves us. Don't forget to be awesome. Let us pray. Holy One of blessing, help us pay attention to how you are moving in this world at this moment. and give us strength and courage to follow, we pray. Amen.